Thank you.
Thank you. Our next case this morning is State v. Sullivan.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Kevin March on behalf of Don Sullivan. If I could reserve 2 minutes, please, for rebuttal. Ms. Sullivan was denied a full and fair opportunity to present a self-defense theory because the trial court denied her request to instruct the jury with a multiple assailants instruction. Ms. Sullivan faced...
Was there anything in the instruction the court gave that prevented counsel from arguing that one of the circumstances it could consider were the number of people she was dealing with?
Yes, Your Honor. The instructions that were given, and I'm referring to instruction number 15 at CP 41, it states that, while it does state that the jury could consider everything that the reasonably prudent person would know under the similar or same conditions, it says that the use of force upon or toward the person of another, and our argument is the singular use of the person, would potentially mislead jurors into believing that Ms. Sullivan was only permitted to use force against...
Well, the force she's defending against is the force she's charged with illegally using, the force against the victim. But that instruction differs from the case that you rely on.
It does somewhat, but the same error is present. In the Irons case that I'm relying on, the instruction was the defendant reasonably believed that the victim intended to inflict death or great bodily harm. The court held that based on the singular use of the victim, even though Mr. Irons was surrounded with multiple assailants, that would have potentially misled the jury and forced defense counsel to...
And my question to you is, what would have prevented defense counsel in this case from asserting that Ms. Sullivan used reasonable force against the victim because of her fear of harm from either the victim or the other individual who was present?
Nothing prevented defense counsel from making that argument. In fact, defense counsel did make that argument. But the problem is that, and this is consistent with Irons, is that defense counsel was faced with making that argument even though there was an inconsistency in the instructions. So because the instructions said the person of another was the only person against whom she was allowed to use lawful force, Ms. Sullivan was actually using lawful force against two persons, the two persons that she testified were attacking her. So that is the issue, is that it would have potentially misled the jury to think that it could only consider Mr. Bohannon's attack as the person against whom she was allowed to use force, not Mr. Bohannon and Mr. Sissel's attacks. So that is our position with regard to...
if you had it in the plural, the persons... Wouldn't that also create a grammatical problem? Because the jury only has to find that the use of force against the victim was lawful, not that the use of force against the other person was, because that crime wasn't charged.
Well, it still leads to an inconsistency with the instructions as written and defense counsel's argument, because the jury could still believe that Ms. Sullivan was only permitted to use... the only permitted to consider the use of her force against the person against whom she ultimately slashed with a knife. She wasn't, the jury could have not, or could read the instructions to think that they could not consider Mr. Sissel's actions in the calculus. And that...
So if we think your reading of that instruction isn't reasonable, is that the end of your argument?
Then I guess that you wouldn't find error if you thought that it was, if you disagreed with my reading of the instruction. However, the Irons' case is instructive on this point because, again, we have the singular as opposed to the plural being used in the instructions. And defense counsel actually, you know, wanted to present this instruction about multiple assailants. It's a correct statement of the law. It was supported by substantial evidence in the record, and the court should have given the instruction. It was error not to give the instruction under those circumstances. And the court looks in the light most favorable to the party proposing the instruction. In this case, it was Ms. Sullivan.
Well, don't we really look to see if each side was allowed to argue its theory of the case under the instructions given?
Yes, but the initial step of that is to determine whether the instruction should have been given. And in this case, the answer is yes. Then if you look at whether
is that could, really it? Every instruction that you give just because, or you proffer just because it's a correct statement of the law means the trial court committed error if it didn't give the instruction?
Our position is yes. Now, whether it has...
That would seem to fly in the face of an awful lot of case law that says that court didn't need to give that instruction because the instructions given were sufficient.
Well, here our argument is that the instructions weren't sufficient because they didn't allow her to fully and fairly argue that she faced multiple assailants. The instruction only instructed that she could use the lawful force.
Is it your position that a different argument would have been presented to the jury had the proffered instruction been given?
No, but defense counsel isn't. The defense counsel's responsibility isn't to tell the jury what the law is. That's the court's responsibility, and the court didn't fulfill that responsibility in this case because the jury instructions as written said that Ms. Sullivan's use of force was lawful toward the person of another rather than the persons, the attackers that she faced.
Why is it that the court did not err in the manner in which it sentenced the defendant considering the decision in Medina?
We acknowledge the decision in Medina. We acknowledge Section 533 of the SRA. And in terms of the trial court seemed to express some very legitimate concerns about this situation. She said that because it was an exact 12-month sentence rather than 12 months in a day, that Medina didn't cover that precise circumstance and directly asked the Court of Appeals to address that issue. Also, our position is that it's inconsistent with the mitigating factor that the trial court relied on to impose an exceptional down. That exceptional down for failed self-defense contemplated that...
What do we do with the dicta in Medina that looks at the 2009, I think it was, amendment to inform it as to the status of the law at the time Mr. Medina's crime was committed and says that this is only available for nonviolent crimes? Well, what words do we put in opinion to distinguish those words?
Your Honor, I'm sorry. Perhaps on rebuttal I'll be able to better answer that question.
Well, that would be a problem for someone writing an opinion that goes the way you're asking it to go.
That's fair, and we have asked this court to just consider the trial court's concerns here, and to the extent that the trial court's concerns demonstrate an inconsistency with Medina, to affirm the sentence the trial court imposed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Donna Wise, representing the state of Washington. I'll just briefly address the issue of the state's appeal and note that not only is it dicta in Medina that the court can't grant credit for the King County Enhanced CCAP program for violent offenses, the statutory language itself specifically says it only applies to nonviolent and non-sex offenses. So I think the court would have to get around that language as well as the dicta in Medina.
Well, it's a lot easier to get around the statute than it is the people that review what we write.
I appreciate that perspective. If there are no other questions about that, I'll discuss the aggressor instructions. The first question that was raised by the defense was whether first aggressor instruction was justified at all. And I think it's clear that the instruction was justified by the evidence that the defendant began the physical confrontation by punching the victim in the face. In fact, the defense concedes that that was provocation in their brief, but they make an argument that because that
argument.
Pardon me?
A continuing act argument.
Exactly, Your Honor. And I would simply like to say that there's no logical or legal support for that argument. And, in fact, the opposite argument was made in the trial court by the defense attorney in the trial court, who argued that there was a break in the action between the punch and the stabbing, and therefore no first aggressor instruction was given. So the premise of the defense trial lawyer was that there had to be a continuing course of conduct, and that's clearly the state of the law. It doesn't make sense to say that the provocation has to be a separate incident than the victim's use of force.
Let me ask you a question about something else.
Sure.
Ms. Sullivan argues that if her appeal fails, we should waive costs in her brief. You don't address that argument in your brief.
That's true.
So does that mean the state's not going to seek costs if Ms. Sullivan should not prevail?
No, it does not, Your Honor.
Well, normally if you don't respond to an argument, we treat it as a concession. Why shouldn't we do that here?
You may. At this point, Your Honor, and at the time I wrote this brief, it's completely unclear what the state of the law is, what our office's policy is, and we simply have insufficient information to say whether the enforcement of costs against Ms. Sullivan would be appropriate. This is not a defendant who's...
So you're not suggesting there's something that would overcome the presumption that Sinclair talks about?
Well, Your Honor, I would dispute the propriety of the assumption that Sinclair makes, that a decision about informa pauperis status at the time that the appeal is filed and even while the appeal is pending establishes that a person is not able to pay. And this court itself said ability to pay is really not the only consideration. All the information we have is that this is a 45-year-old woman who's looking at a minimal amount of jail time if the state's appeal succeeds, about 8 months of jail time. I can't make an argument about whether appellate costs are appropriate or not without any information about it. And perhaps, you know, Division III's approach with its latest general order might be more helpful if the defendant were required to provide some information about their continuing financial status. It's sort of arguing in a vacuum that was simply not worth the investment of time.
I don't mean this as a criticism of you. I'm just trying to figure out what your position is.
And I'm trying to honestly respond to that, Your Honor. If I may return to the...
You may go to whatever other topic
Thank you
want. I think we've exhausted that.
All right. As to the issue of aggressor instructions, Your Honor, just on the issue of continuing course of conduct, would just ask the court, if the court has any doubts about it, to review the facts of the cases where the court has held the aggressor instruction is appropriate. In each of them, there's a continuing course of conduct. Nothing else makes sense. That's the B case, the Riley case, the Ward case out of this court. As to the instruction itself, I would note that this argument that the language of the instruction given, instruction 15, that the misleading language is upon or toward the person of another, that argument was first raised in the reply brief. So I'm not sure how confusing it could have been if the defense itself, who's looking for an error, doesn't even see it in their first in their opening brief. But I want to point out that Irons did not just refer and find error in the reference to the victim intending to inflict harm. But the instruction in Irons also said the defendant reasonably believed there was imminent danger of that harm, again directing the jury back to the danger presented by the specific victim. In contrast, the instruction in this case couldn't have been broader in talking about what the danger would have been. It talks about the defendant reasonably believing she is about to be injured, There's no subject related to about to be injured. It talks about what a reasonably prudent person, the force they would use under the same or similar conditions, considering all the facts and circumstances, which certainly includes the fact that there are multiple other people present, and whether or not they're using force would be relevant to that. There was no suggestion in closing argument. Both the attorneys, the prosecutor and the defense attorney, argued about both men and their participation in the events of that night. The state's position was that there was no attack by the men, so it had no reason to particularly directly argue about that. But it certainly made no suggestion that the defendant couldn't consider the force used by Mr. Cecil if he used force, and the defense certainly made that argument. I also wanted to reiterate my argument that the proposed instruction by the defense was a comment on the evidence, asking the court to tell the jurors that two or more people are more likely to inflict injury than one. Although that was language used by the court in Irons, it's simply an observation. It's not a statement that, as a matter of law, the jury will be told that. Unless the court has further questions, I'd ask the court to affirm the conviction and reverse the sentence imposed.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Just briefly respond to the issue that counsel raised regarding it being a comment on the evidence. Irons set forth the law. When a person faces multiple assailants, that person is allowed to use more force to repel their attacks. There's no comment on the evidence that occurs by the recitation of that correct statement of law.
Wouldn't it be more accurate to say that person is permitted to use more force if the circumstances warrant it?
Perhaps, Your Honor, but there's the way the defense instruction that was proposed.
It's got two people. One's confined to a wheelchair and paralyzed from the neck down. We wouldn't just count people and say you can use more force.
That's correct, that it would always, and instructions can become misleading and work in one case and not work in another based on the facts, as Your Honor states. Yes. In this case, however, the jury instructions had the potential to mislead because Ms. Sullivan faced two attackers, and the instruction said that she was permitted to use lawful force only towards the person of another. Both of her attackers were able-bodied men, and because the instruction says the person of another, the jury could potentially be misled to believing that they could only consider Mr. Bohannon's, not Mr. Sissel's, actions. And that's consistent with what this court stated in Irons. When you have a singular term used in this fashion, it can mislead the jury, and then it burdens defense because defense not only has to argue her theory of the case, defense counsel also has to convince the jury what the law is. That's trial court's responsibility, and the trial court failed to uphold its responsibility in this case. We'd ask that this court reverse. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.